Hey everyone, welcome to the Racing Riders Podcast. I'm your host, Kelly Crandall. Got a great episode for you today with the champ, three-time NHRA Pro Stock Motorcycle Champion, Angel Sampay is here. An absolute honor to have her on the podcast for many reasons, and not just because we had a fantastic conversation today. Angel, as I said, is a three-time champion. She has 46 national event wins, the winningest female in the NHRA as well as all of professional motorsports, chasing a fourth championship this year, and she believes she has the team to do it and the team to beat this year for the Pro Stock Motorcycle Championship. Angel drives the Mission Foods Vance and Hines Suzuki. We learn a lot about what goes into being a pro stock motorcycle racer in the NHRA, how the season is going. She was the number one qualifier at Sonoma, Bristol, and Charlotte. She has a win at Norwalk and just a very, very consistent team and bike. So we dig into how the season is going as the countdown, which is the NHRA's version of the playoffs, is quickly approaching. As this episode drops today, it is September 5th, the NHRA and Angel are still on track in Indianapolis, wrapping up their biggest event of the year, the U.S. Nationals. So who knows, maybe Angel will have added another win to the column and set herself up even better for when the countdown starts. That is actually the next event after Indianapolis, September 15th, 16th, 17th, and 18th at Maple Grove Raceway. And as I said, she is very excited to be chasing that fourth championship. In addition to that, we're going to dig into, of course, her career. She is the champ. She is the GOAT, an absolute legend in the NHRA. And there is even a NASCAR connection that I've been teasing that I can't wait for you all to hear. So again, fantastic conversation. Absolutely honored to have Angel on the podcast. And here it is for you to enjoy. Angel Sampay on the Racing Riders Podcast. Angel, you did say you're in Louisiana. I love how on your Twitter bio you say you're in the swamp. I wanted to check in. How is everything down there? It's not even a year later, I don't think, from the hurricane. And I know
that's right.
Yeah, I know last year you brought a lot of attention to trying to help Louisiana. So how is everything down there right now?
We actually are still not all the way back to normal. I mean, if you pass through here, you might think that some of the things you see are just, we still have lots of houses with blue roofs on them, you know, the tarps that are on them. And you here in Louisiana, you see a lot of that anyway. So you might, it might to you look like it's normal, but to we know some things that haven't been fixed. We will be a year, it'll be a year anniversary on August 29th, which is actually the same day that Katrina hit us as well. So we had a anniversary hurricane on Katrina. So Hurricane Ida hit on the same day as Hurricane Katrina. But anyway, so I know that there's still a lot of people further down, we call it down the bayou, depending on which way you're heading. South is down the bayou, heading north on the bayou. I live in a town called Matthews, right along Bayou Lafourche. And it's literally three directions to go from my house. You can either go down the bayou, up the bayou, or across the bayou. That's how you get everywhere. So when I say down the bayou, it's a little further south, closer to the Gulf. They are still, you know, trying to get back to normal. There's a lot of people still living in FEMA trailers. I heard there was even still people living in tents and stuff like that. So, you know, some people that are very financially handicapped from this whole thing. But typically in my area, you can't tell a whole bunch. We actually just, our McDonald's, it's been about maybe 3 weeks now, we finally got a new McDonald's sign. The M at McDonald's looked like a pretzel. So it's been like that since the hurricane. And I think it was about 3 weeks they finally put a new one up. So it takes a long time to get back to normal after something like that happens. And now we're full-fledged in the middle of hurricane season all over again. I hate to even say it, but nothing so far. We've been good. Haven't heard anything. So hopefully we'll get a big, long break like we did between Katrina and Ida.
Hopefully. Well, if anything that you have shown people is that everyone down there is very persistent. So I'm sure everybody is, you know, putting their hard hat on and continuing on. Let's talk a little bit racing, of course. We're coming off a weekend where Topeka, you had that second round loss, but you tweeted something really interesting that got my attention because you said that your team, you guys are going to be a force, or you are a force to be reckoned with. How do you feel, Angel, as The countdown is fast approaching. So how do you feel about your team and about your bike right now, where you guys are?
You know, I would like to try to say this without sounding any way other than I want it to sound, not in a conceited way, not in a boastful way, but my team is the one to beat. And I know that, you know, we've been to, I think, every semifinal, every final for the last five races or so. There's other teams that have been very, very strong, like Steve Johnson, who won the first two races and almost won the third. And then Joey, who runs Vance and Hines equipment, has been to several finals and won two races in a row. So when I say we're the team to beat, not everybody might agree with that, but I know what we have. And we've just been bit by a little bit of bad luck. Some of it's been my fault. You know, that red light I had in Bristol, the red light I had in Ohio. I strongly believe that my bike was the one to win the race. Driver error does happen, and I keep my team from winning sometimes. This past weekend in Topeka, we had electrical issues and didn't get the win there. Eddie was in the final, but his bike just fell off. Something happened with the tune-up, and he didn't run the run that he needed. But I do believe that we are the team to beat. I believe that we have everything we need to win this championship. We have everything we need to win all these races. It just takes all the stars aligning. I've said that many, many times. Luck is just as important in drag racing as skill or preparation. So once we have all of those in line with us on the weekend, we're really, really hard to beat.
I love that you say that, because me looking on the outside in, when you say the team to beat, the thing that stands out that I can get behind that is because it seems like, again, when you take some of the luck out of it, it seems like you and your team have had a very consistent bike and a very consistent season. Mm-hmm. So that's going to go a long way, that if you can have that before the countdown even starts, right?
Yeah. That's definitely the word that I'm working on for myself, is consistency. As soon as I can get my reaction times to stay where I want them, I seem to be able to do it with no problem qualifying. It changes a little bit on race day. I know I can do it. I am nowhere near not able to have a good reaction time or cut a good light or shift on time or do all the things I need to do. I'm very capable physically of doing all that. It's to stop letting that gremlin in my head get me to believe that something might go wrong or I might make a mistake and mess this up for my whole team. That's what I'm fighting. So I'm not fighting my competition. I'm not fighting the motorcycle. I'm 100% fighting my own self. And as soon as I fix that, and I'm on the way to fixing that, there was a time in my career where I, in my own head, was invincible and unbeatable. And I'd like to get back there again someday soon, like today, because that's where I need to do it. And I did it in Ohio. You know, when we won the race in Ohio, I was pretty strong mentally and physically, and we ended up getting the win. And I have to be able to do that every weekend. So that's what I'm working on.
Yeah. When you say mentally, I respect the fact you made that comment a couple weeks ago that confidence is such a big thing in drag racing, really in all of motorsports. But you admitted that even after 25 years, you're still learning how to ride the bike, and you have to have that self-confidence to go out there and get it done. And so, as you said, it's very much a big mental game as it is of what the bike is doing on the racetrack.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. It's, the motorcycle just keeps going faster and faster each year. So when you think you have it, you get 3 or 4 months off and you come back. And my team in particular has my motorcycle flying even more than it did the last time I rode it. So you can never get too comfortable in your own set of skills, because everything changes. The body style changes, the engine horsepower changes, the weather on a particular day will change from, you know, how it was the last time you were at that racetrack. You know, when I might be able to finally have it mastered with a tailwind or a headwind, and then we go to the next race and there's a really strong left to right crosswind, and now I have a whole nother challenge to overcome. So it, just because I've been out here for 25 years and I know how to do this, doesn't mean that it makes it easy. I feel like I have to continually stay focusing on the basics and how to get the track from point A to point B, but I have to constantly work with keeping up with the motorcycle and keeping up with how the improvements that my crew chief and my team make. You know, last year my brain was used to a certain number and a certain timing with shifting and stuff like that. And then you come back this year. And even if it's just a from a 685 to a 680, or 679, that's a whole different timing and everything changes. And so you have to keep up with it. And that's what goes on with us. And I think that anybody in this sport, if they get too confident or too complacent, it's very easy to figure out how fast you can go from hero to zero. And that's something that I try not to do. Even if I won four races in a row, you can't go to the fifth race thinking you got this because everything can go wrong, and it usually does.
The skill set it takes to ride a pro stock motorcycle. I want to get kind of nerdy here for a second because you just said some things there about the variables that come into play. Wind. I'm curious how much goes into driving that bike for you in terms of, again, there's the wind, there's what you have to do with your body. I'm sure that's a science, right, of how you have to lean and use your body. Can you just break it down for me of just how sensitive the bike is, just everything you're feeling and that you have to do behind the wheel, whereas some people might look at drag racing and have that stupid cliche, it's just going from A to B in a straight line, when we know it's not.
A lot of people think that, as a matter of fact. I've heard it myself, signing autographs. I've heard people talk about, all you have to do is hold the throttle open and push a button to shift. And that is so not true. Every little bitty step along the way is so important, even from the very beginning of doing a burnout. If you don't do the burnout correctly, you can mess up the whole run. And I actually just did it recently at a race or two ago, started the burnout. You rev the engine up, you pop the clutch. We do it in third gear. Spin that back tire. You have to keep the RPMs level and high enough to where you can keep that tire spinning and you don't drag the engine down too much, because if you do drag the engine down too much, you're also pulling on the clutch too much and overheating it, which changes the whole setup that the crew chief has you set up for to leave the starting line. And what I did was I had the engine going, I listened to it, I can feel it pulling me, I can hear it, and it started dropping down and pulling me. And instead of turning the throttle a little bit more like I normally do, I let it pull me out of the burnout, and it bogged the engine down a little bit too much, and it jammed the transmission in the middle of a couple of, two gears, where it locked up the transmission. So when I was in third gear, it got caught up between third and fourth or something. I don't know exactly what happened, but when I came out, it just like stopped dead, like the brakes were on because it was locked up. Had that been a race, I think, matter of fact, I think it was a race. I'm trying to remember if it was qualifying or a race. As a matter of fact, I think it happened to Gianna Salinas' first round. I'm not sure that's what was going on with her motorcycle, but I think her transmission may have locked up on her and she was unable to make the run. So I had a bye run first round of competition. So what I was going to say is, had my team not been aware of what had happened, if I had not been aware of what had happened and called them over to help me fix it, we would have been done. But they came over, and Andrew or Eddie, I can't remember who did it, got the bike back in neutral for me. I got it back in first gear. We went up to the start line and we made the run. So something that small can ruin everything. But then you pull up to the starting line, your seating position, how you're, on the motorcycle when you pop the clutch. Sometimes I've seen people, myself included, not ready when you throw the clutch out. You think you manually threw your hand out, but your brain said, nope, not happening like that. And there's like a glitch in your mental system to where everything in your body moves but your hand. And then when you finally do move your hand, now your body goes the opposite direction and you get pulled back and the bike's going forward. And that upsets the whole motorcycle. And what it did to me when I did it this past weekend is the bike just kind of lifts off the ground, spins the tire real bad, might wiggle and not go straight. So every little thing from popping the clutch on the burnout to popping the clutch on the starting line has to be precise. It has to be the same. It has to be graceful. You don't want all kind of herky jerky pulling and jumping off the bike unless you absolutely have to. And then your shift points have to be precise. And we have about a 200 RPM window, which I don't know in time what that equals out to. I think it's like 0.2 seconds. When that shift light comes on, you have to push the button right on time. If you're too early, it does one thing to the clutch. You do late, it does a whole nother thing. You can over rev the engine and hurt the engine. crosswinds will move the bike left to right, just like a sail in the wind. And so when the bike's driving to the right, you have to jump off the left side of it and pull it back. But at the same time, you don't want to lean the motorcycle. This isn't a street bike. It isn't road racing. We have a 10-inch wide slick on the back of it. We want all 10 inches of that rubber on the ground. So if you're leaning the motorcycle, you have 9 or 8 inches of rubber sticking to the ground, and that's not good. Tucking your arms, your elbows, your toes, getting everything, get your head down as much as you can. Keeping the throttle wide open. One thing that happens when I'm having to correct the motorcycle, if I'm leaning off to the left to fix it, my arm will straighten out and sometimes my wrist will lift unintentionally and I'll roll off the throttle, 5 or 6%. And in these kind of races, when we're looking for, a thousandth of a second to beat the competition, you can't do that. So there is so much involved with the driver on a pro cycle motorcycle than any other category. So I believe that we are the most difficult category in the pro category. I think pro mod is like really crazy, but pro stock bikes take so much from the driver, so much from the engine builders and tuners, and so much from the bike itself. Not only do I think we're the most difficult, I just think we're the greatest and coolest and most interesting. And I wish all the fans felt that way too, but they love that ground pounding thunder from the top fuel cars because they don't really understand what goes into getting our bikes on the track.
Right. And that's why I wanted to ask that, because it gives me a whole new appreciation for it. And the fact that you can break it all down like that explains why you have won 3 championships and 46 national events, because you know what you're doing.
And then if actually when you go through the finish line, it's a whole nother set of things you have to go through to stop the motorcycle carefully. So some people really want to pull that clutch in and shut the engine off as soon as possible. My crew chief, Andrew, allows me to roll off the throttle before I pull in the clutch and let the engine do some braking for me, because some of these racetracks are so short and so bumpy that you have to be just as precise and just as smooth on slowing the bike down as you are getting it up to the top speed. Because when that back tire is bouncing on bumps, and the shutdown's really short, and there's a crosswind that you're fighting at the same time, you have to be very careful on the front brakes and the back brakes at the same time, equal amount of braking or more front brake than less back brake, depending on the situation. And sometimes you'll see people lock up the front brake. There's white smoke comes off the tire. The whole front end of the bike washes out from under them. I've seen somebody crash doing that. So it's just as important and just as much skill to stop the bike as it is to get it to the finish line safely.
Absolutely. I don't think I would ever have enough time to go through everything I wanted to ask you about motorcycle racing or just your career, but I would love to hit a few things here. From what I understand, your brother was supposed to be the racer, but everybody has an origin story. So I wanted to go back and I'm curious, when was it for you that your love of two wheels and dirt bikes and then eventually motorcycles, when did that start for you? Because I know your dad had pushed a lot into your brother doing it. And then you stood up and said, oh, wait a minute.
Yeah. I was 6 years old when I got my first motorcycle. Not sure how long my brother had been racing before that. It wasn't a whole bunch of time before, but he was racing and I was at the racetrack motocross racing with him. And my dad and my mom would try to get me to play dolls with the sisters of the boys who were racing, but that's not what I wanted. I wanted to be racing. So I complained and put up enough of a fight to have my own motorcycle till they finally got me one. I believe it was my 6th Christmas. We were actually still living with my grandmother at the time. The motorcycle was in front of the Christmas tree when I woke up and I started riding. My brother did a lot of the teaching, to instruct me on how to ride. He's 5 years older than me. My dad, of course, as well, had cousins, uncles, and friends out there. I don't think I started racing immediately. I know it was, at least a few months after I got the bike that they actually let me compete in a race. But once I was in there, that was it. I was done, hooked. I don't really know where the passion for bikes comes from. My mom put me in ballet when I was 3 years old, 3 and 4 and 5 years old, thinking that that was going to be the route I took. I didn't like it, did it for a little while, but I wanted out and I wanted motorcycles. So it's kind of weird because my dad, he's a motorcycle guy, but not even as much as I am. My brother loves motorcycles, but not as much as I am. My mom doesn't want anything to do with motorcycles. I don't know where it came from. I don't know what happened. but I am completely, utterly in love, addicted to, and passionate about motorcycles. I cannot imagine my life without it. I just can't. It's what I live for.
It's funny you say there about what your mom wanted you to do, and I read there was also some beauty pageants involved. So there was like this push-pull of the complete opposite ends of the spectrum. And I just imagine, again, with your love of racing, and once you were hooked, that you wanted to be outside getting dirty and having fun on two wheels or four wheels. And then there was mom who was like, I can't believe this.
Yeah, my mom. Well, it was actually my dad's idea not to put me in pageants, but he told my mom to do something with me because I was too much of a tomboy. And he was tired of, he'd come home from work and there would be boys hanging out at my house. We're all just sitting around in the garage talking about bikes, working on bikes. And he has had enough. He's like, this is my daughter. Y'all gonna get the heck out of here. And he told my mom, do something with her. Well, my mom, I guess, must have asked around and found out that there was a pageant coming up. So she entered me into it. It was pretty funny. I was pathetic. Like, I was so mad. There's pictures of me in this pageant, and I had this, excuse my language, pissed off look on my face. Like, this is so stupid. I'm wearing a stupid dress. She has stupid makeup on my face. And I was just so mad that this was happening. And I ended up winning the pageant. I don't know how. Apparently, sometime on the stage, I must have smiled, but I ended up winning it. And then I realized that this was competition. And I'm competitive, whether it's playing checkers or video games or racing motorcycles, I have to win. And so when I realized how competitive the pageant world was, we got into it. So we did a lot of that. But I struggled to win the really big pageants. I was either third, second, or first runner up, not winning. And there's this one time my mom finally went and talked to the judges after the pageant. She said, okay, we need to know, what do we need to do to get her over the hump to win? You know, instead of runner up, how does she get the queen? And I swear this is not a joke. One of the judges told my mom, well, you could possibly get her to talk about something other than motorcycles in her interview. It was like, that's all I was about. It was somehow every question they asked me, I would end up leading it into talking about motorcycles at the end of it. And I didn't know any of the things I needed to know. I remember one time they asked about the difference in the political parties, Democrat and Republican. I was like, I have no idea. But I could tell you about the difference between a Suzuki and a Honda or a two valve and four valve. It was so funny. But so the pageants were fun, and I ended up winning. I was Miss St. Charles Parish, which was a preliminary into the Miss Louisiana, which I ended up not doing. But I'm so glad I did the pageants because what I got from them was, not only did it teach me how to be a girl and, you know, do my hair and makeup and introduce me to a whole nother world, but it allowed me to be able to speak in public, present myself well. You know, when we got to the racetrack and there was a camera in my face, everybody else that's new at this is so scared to talk and they don't know what to say. And I was just talking my head off because I was just so used to it already. I was in front of people all the time. So it really worked out. You never know. And I try to say that when I talk to people, when I do motivational speaking with kids especially, I always tell them to take every opportunity you can to get, what's the word I'm looking for, experience in anything that you can think of in life that might help you. You know, let's say you want to be a doctor, but you don't think that learning how to, out of loss of words right now, learning how to do something that has nothing to do with being a doctor. It doesn't matter. Learn it anyway. Because every bit of experience you get will help you be well-rounded. And I think that's why I'm so happy that my mom put me in pageants, even though I thought they were stupid in the beginning.
I love that story. I love it so much. Oh my goodness. When you make it to the NHRA, 1996 was your debut, of course. I was looking through some old videos and photos, and I noticed that on your leathers by one of your shoulders, it said CJ. Were you in borrowed leathers to start?
No, that was it's funny that you noticed that because nobody ever asks that. Those were my leathers. We had them custom done. I'm so different now. There's no way I'd wear purple and pink leathers. But anyway, so the CJ was the team that I was with, which still to this day people can't say Angel. It's a Cajun French name in Louisiana, and no one on my team could say Angel, so they called me Crawfish Gel. So CJ was crawfish gel because I'm a Cajun who likes crawfish. I don't know how they came up with that name, but they all just started calling me CJ. So he ended up with it on my leathers, and that whole team did refer to me as CJ for a while, for a long time. It's always Angel, Angela, Angelie. It's nobody gets Angel right. And I don't know if you look very young. You probably wouldn't remember this, but is it Demi Moore? Yeah, Demi Moore. Her name is Demi. It's not Demi. It's Demi. And one day I was watching her on a talk show. This was 25 years ago or longer before I started racing. And they said her name. They said, and we have Demi Moore. She's like, it's not Demi. It's Demi. And when she said it, I thought, what a bitch. I mean, like, she was kind of rude to the person that she was correcting. And I didn't like her after that. Well, then I started racing and everybody was calling me Angel, Angel, Angel. And I wanted to tell them it's not Angel, it's Angel, but I would never say it because of how I perceived Demi Moore. So I never corrected anybody. And it's one of my biggest regrets in my whole career is that I didn't teach people how to say Angel from the very beginning. And I try to tell them now, I just very careful with how I say it. It doesn't hurt my feelings or bother me when somebody says my name wrong. I don't even care. You know, I let a lot of people say it that way, but I just wish that I would have taught people from the beginning just so people would know who the heck I really am. There's actually a lot of little girls named after me and all their names are Angel. They don't even say it right. And that's like, man, Angel is so much prettier than Angel.
But I do love it. I do
let it go.
It. Yeah. I think for the record, I have said it correctly. So hopefully I'm back. We'll keep that going. You, of course, were tied to Winston for quite a while there earlier in your career. Is it true that obviously Winston, RJ Reynolds, was big in the stock car world? Was there ever an opportunity? Did they try to put you in a stock car and test at any point?
They did. How do you know that?
sources?
Not too many people know that.
Well, I pride myself on research and sources, so I don't know if you were allowed to admit that, but I wanted to take
at the time I was not. It was a huge secret. Of course, it's not anymore. But they actually flew. I wish I could remember exactly what year it was. I know I had won the championship the year that it happened, one of the years. And they flew me from California to Greenville Pickens Speedway, I think was the name of it. And on the Winston jet, it was so awesome. And we got there and Richard Childress was there and Kevin Harvick, who nobody knew who he, I mean, not that nobody knew who he was. He was not in the cup car yet. He was still in the lower, I guess it was the, I don't know if it was Busch series, what they called it, but he was in that lower class. And Richard Childress was on the radio talking to me. I was in the car. Kevin got in the car first and warmed it up. He made several laps around the track and they had timed him. I did not have any clue what I was doing. They put me in this car. They strapped me in. I was wearing my motorcycle helmet. The seat didn't even fit. They had to put some styrofoam and stuff for me to get in it. And they told me to go out and drive the car around the racetrack. And they wanted to see how I did and how I liked it because they had an idea that they were going to put me in a Winston Cup car. So got out there, started running it. I think I made about 20 laps, was doing really good considering that, you know, how far behind I was Kevin's time, which wasn't too bad that from what they told me. I don't remember the time exactly. And Richard tells me in my radio that the car is starting to break loose, that I need to bring it in. And I didn't understand what he said. I heard him say something, but I was having too much fun. So I kept going and it did. It broke loose. The car spun around. I went into the wall face first, you know, the nose of the car went into the wall and then it backed up and went backwards into the other wall. And my head hit the steering wheel so hard. I had my visor up that it went into my helmet and hit me. Maybe I had to open. I can't remember. I thought I had my racing helmet on. Anyway, somehow it hit my forehead and it was like on a cartoon. Remember the cartoons when somebody gets hit with something and the bump goes whoop? My head literally did that. It hit my forehead so hard that it just blew up with this hematoma on my forehead. And they ended up having to take me to the hospital. And the next couple of days, the blood had come down from the hematoma on my forehead under my eyes. I had two big old black eyes. They didn't want anybody to know what we were doing. So I had to tell everybody that I got in a car accident in the rental car at the racetrack. They asked me later, you know, how did I feel about it? Did I want to do it again? And I was like, absolutely not. just wasn't me. Wasn't for me. I don't want to go in circles. I want to go straight. I don't like four wheels. I want to be on two. So we never pursued it. I kind of regret it. I wish that I would have at least tried it again. But I thought to myself, you know, it was fun when I was the only car on the racetrack. I just can't imagine 40 more out there inside of me. So no, I don't think I want to do this.
I love it. I love it. I think it worked out pretty well for you again. Championships and 46 national wins in NHRA. It worked out pretty well. You said early on in your career, Angel, that you were afraid of being a girl in racing. And you told this great story, I think, to NHRA on Fox a couple years ago of when you went to drag racing school, of the things you did to try to like hide it. And you admitted that that mm-hmm. was stupid. How long did it take you to get over that fear of being a girl in racing, if that makes sense?
Yeah, it does. I'm not afraid of it anymore, but I never did capitalize on that. And I do regret that. So from the very beginning, I never wanted anybody to look at me as a female on the motorcycle, because I always thought that they would not give me a chance. You know, a girl can't do it. You're too little. You're not strong enough. So I figured it was going to hinder my chances, my opportunities being a girl. And so I don't know why I thought I'd be able to hide that and stop myself, or, you know, get anybody to let me do something, because I had a baseball cap on and no makeup on, which was stupid, but that's just was my thought processes back then. And then actually, once I started competing and, you know, they know it's a girl on the bike, there still was really stupid things said about me. This one guy that we were competing against, he was actually a team owner. He used to race a long time ago. He told my team owner that he didn't want his driver in the other lane against me because I was probably going to crash into his driver and hurt him. And they didn't trust me on the bike. So there was things said about that. And I related all of that to me being a girl and being small. So that's why I felt that way. And I didn't want to really, you know, advertise being a female. It was also one of the biggest mistakes of my career, because when I came out, there weren't many girls in any of the categories. There was only, you know, one or two other girls attempting to race pro stock bikes. There was one or two other girls in top field. There was nobody in pro stock car. I don't think there was anybody in funny car at the time. And that was a time that I really should have just made the world aware of, hey, I'm a girl. I should have had the bling on my leathers back then. I should have had something pink and sparkly, but I don't know. I don't know why I couldn't understand that back then. I think youth had a lot to do with it, and inexperience and not understanding how to market myself. So I missed that opportunity big time, because by the time I realized that marketing the fact that I'm a female was what I should be doing, it was no longer a big deal anymore. There were so many girls out there now. And that's what NHRA is. We're well known for the fact that it doesn't matter what gender you are, doesn't matter what race you are, doesn't matter what age you are. Anyone can be successful in drag racing. So that whole thing, I missed out on that opportunity. It came and went a long time ago. And now it's like, I'm almost back into that same situation for a whole nother reason. So I don't want anybody to look at me and think that I'm a girl who's getting too old to do this. And it's almost like I'm trying to fight my own self, or the, you know, what the public opinion of who I am and what I am, when I shouldn't care. I should be marketing myself again. You know, I'm 52 years old now. I've been doing this for 26 years, and I'm still out here kicking your ass. That's how I should say it. But here I am, that gremlin in my head is telling me maybe you can't do this anymore. And that's what I was talking about earlier when I said I'm fighting myself.
You say there about kicking everybody's asses. I actually have a question about that. But before I get to that, on the topic of females in NHRA, because you brought up a great point. I mean, there are so many. They're successful. Yourself, obviously, Erica, Camry's now, Caruso's mm-hmm. now come along in pro stock car. And I wanted to bring her up because I had her on the show a couple weeks ago, and I asked her about the Instagram comment that I saw you had left on one of her posts. So I asked her about the relationship and how cool that was for her, coming from you, a champion, and just your relationship. So I wanted to get your perspective on what you've seen in Camry, because you seem to have been very excited for her and her early success.
Oh, yeah. I was just talking to her this weekend. We hung out for a little bit. I think she's precious. I love her. I'm so glad that she is here. because we needed another female in pro stock car. You know, just having one is great, but the more the merrier. Our class gets a lot of attention in bikes because we have several females. So it's good for the whole sport that she's here. But there's something about her that I like because she's so natural and real and cute and young and talented. I mean, she came out here. It's actually one of the things I was talking to her about this weekend. I was asking her, how hard is it hard to drive those cars? Because I know there's a lot that goes into a pro stock car, just like bikes. And so she was talking to me a little bit about driving it and what it takes to get it down the track straight. So I don't know. I like her. I hope she does well. I can't wait to see her win. I was excited for her to get that number one qualifier. I'd love to see her and Erica in a final. I think that would just boost the whole sport tremendously because we've never had that in pro stock. So, but my ultimate goal in this whole thing is to be on the stage for Winner's Circle with all four females and all the classes. I know that that's going to happen one day, and I want it so bad to happen while I'm still here. I want to be there. I want to be the one on the stage for the bikes.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to that.
I'm looking forward to it. I hope it happens as well. I have a couple more things for you. You took, of course, that 5-year break from 09 to 13. There was the sponsorship issue. You wanted to start a family. You come back, and as you said, kicking everybody's asses. Is it kind of surreal, Angel, to have come back, you're with such a fantastic team? You mentioned Andrew, who you all were rivals back in the day, and now you're a team together accomplishing all these things. Is it kind of surreal to be right back on top and right in the midst of everything again?
It is. And while you were asking that question, my mind wandered off to realize that I haven't once spoken about my sponsors. And so that's part of this question. And I'm going to try to include all of them because it is a whole 360 degree circle that has happened for me. So I actually finished the 2008 season and did not come back until the very end of 2014. So it was almost 6 years that I didn't even sit on a motorcycle. When I left, I had been very successful. The last year of my career in 2008, not so much, didn't win a race that year, but I had won so many races before and it seemed almost easy. You know, I won the fourth race I came to, was number one qualifier, had set the world record and won so many after that. So it was almost like I didn't struggle too much in the beginning. And then when I came back in 2014, oh my gosh, it was a huge struggle. Like I couldn't get the bike down the track. And I thought to myself, I can't do this anymore. And I made a huge mistake coming back here. But I did it for my daughter. I wanted to show her what's possible to accomplish if you set your mind to something. And then I started to think I've made a huge mistake. You know, I'm out here to show her how she could be successful and I'm failing. But that actually ended up being a blessing in disguise because what it taught her was that I came back, I struggled, I worked hard, I never quit. And then I started winning again. So it taught her the lesson that I ultimately wanted her to learn. And now I have two daughters. I adopted my little cousin, who's now my daughter. We've been having her since 2017. But anyway, what I want to say with that the whole 360 degree circle that has happened is when I first started my career, Vance and Hines, who's my current team, my sponsor, was my biggest enemy, my biggest rival. They were who I wanted to beat the most. And when I came back, I eventually ended up on the Vance and Hines team. You know, a whole nother story of how that happened. But I feel like now I am where I belong. This is where I'm going to finish my career. I'm so excited to be with this team. They are truly unbelievable. I call them the NASA team of pro stock motorcycles. They're just, Andrew's so intelligent and talented. He's the best pro stock motorcycle racer in all of the world. My teammate Eddie is the second best. He's got, you know, second most wins. I have Byron Hines and Terry Vance behind me, supporting me in every way. And then we also regained our Suzuki deal. We're the Suzuki factory team again, which is how I started my career. And then we were able to bring in a huge, awesome new sponsor to the sport with Mission. So we'll have lots of Mission tortillas and Mission chips and salsa and cheese dip on board all the time. And I love them so much because they're so active in motorsports. I know you probably are aware of what all they do in every type of motorsports. Lots of great drivers. They do awesome work with all the drivers. We do a lot of fun stuff with them with the videos we do. And I really am so glad because when I first came back, I was questioning if I had made the right decision because I was a mom now, and I didn't know if leaving my kids at home and missing so much of their lives was the right thing to do. But because of the way everything has fallen into place, and my kids love what I do, and I get to go to school on career day, and I'm invited to do talks with the schools a lot of, and it's just everything's working out perfectly. And I think that, you know, I'm successful again, not winning as much as I'd like to, and that's been my fault, but it's fallen into place for me with the right people at the right time. And I'm looking forward to ending it the way I want to. And my goal with that is to win another championship before I call it quits.
Right. I have two more questions for you. And as we circle it back to the here and now, talking about championships and wins, 50 wins, that's got to be a new goal. Like I said, you got
it is.
Six. Yeah.
Yeah. That I always have to have something to shoot for. My biggest goal after I won a championship, won races, set national team records, was to be the winningest pro stock motorcycle racer ever. And I would have accomplished that if Eddie Krawick and Andrew Hines didn't exist. Because I passed up Dave Schultz, and I would have been the winningest. Andrew just set that bar so high. It's so far out there. I think I could get there. I just don't know how much time I have left in the sport. But so that kind of that goal kind of fell off my chart, you know. And then it's like, what am I going to reach for now? I have to have something to reach for. So I started thinking, well, what about 50? How great would it be to hit 50 wins? It's actually one of Eddie's goals. He's at 49. He wants to hit 50. So that's possible. That's possible this year if I get my head out of my butt, do what I need to do on the starting line. You know, we have six or so races to go, and I only need four more wins. So I could maybe do it this year, maybe do it next year. I don't know, but that's what I'm reaching for. And then if I get to the 50, well, Andrew, I'm coming after you. So he knows that I would like to pass him up on wins. He is not racing right now. He is my full-time crew chief. So he's giving me a little time to catch up. If he gets back on the bike, then he's probably going to, you know, push that goal even further for me. But we'll see what happens.
It makes it a little easier because he's your crew chief right now. So you can, yeah. It's easier. You can just keep him locked up and say, no, you're not allowed on the bike anytime soon.
That's right. He says that my wins now are also his wins, which they very much are. So he's got a couple more wins under his belt as me as his rider because, you know, he's tuning that motorcycle to the finish line. So I don't know if we're going to count those for his personal race wins. I think he has 57 now. It's either 57 or 58. I can't ever remember.
Oh my!
And then he's in the 60s, 60 something maybe with my wins too that he's crew chiefed me for.
Well, don't give him that head start. Don't let them keep adding wins on. We started our conversation on gel talking about this year, your team, the confidence, the countdown fast approaching. So my last question to wrap this up is you spoke of you need the skill, you need a little bit of luck to go your way. So that kind of answers the question I was going to ask about what it's going to take to get number four. So let me ask this instead. How much is there a driving force for you this year of coming up short last year when I know you felt like last year in the championship, you could have pulled that one off?
Yeah, that was definitely my fault too. I was late on the light in the final race of the year. I could have done it. I know we could have done it, but it wasn't meant to be. It was definitely Matt's championship to win. You know, he won a lot of races. He did a great job, but I did let my team down. I let Vance and Hines admission down. I could have done it, but it didn't happen. So coming back this year, yes, it's there's some pressure on that I'm putting on myself to do this. I know that my team wants to do it. Andrew stepping off of the motorcycle to be my full-time crew chief is all part of it. You know, we feel like we have a better chance with him at my side the whole time instead of I need to speak to my crew chief and he's on the motorcycle in the other lane. And that has happened to us. So they've made some sacrifices. They're doing everything they can to give me the opportunity to have a fourth championship. I have the motorcycle to do it. I call her Beauty. She's a beast. She's everything I need to get it done. I just have to get it done. And I'm working on that. And I know the opportunity is there. I feel really confident. I really believe we have a great chance of getting another championship this year. So I'm going to give my best, try my hardest, but try not to be too suicidal if I screw it up again. But hopefully I won't. Maybe we'll get it this time.
Well, I completely understand. It's all about that competitive nature. It's just wins are wins and losses are not acceptable.
They're not. And this sport is so hard. You know, you only have 6 seconds to get it right from the time you pop the clutch to the finish line. It's not a 4-hour football game or a 400-mile NASCAR race. You make one little tiny mistake and your day is over right there in a split second. And so this sport, you really have to come into it knowing that you're not going to win as much as you're going to lose. That's just a fact. I don't care who you are. John Force, who has 18 or whatever championships, is not going to win as much as he loses. And coming into the sport as competitive as I am and feeling like I need to win to breathe is really, really hard. It's always been difficult on me. It's never gotten easier. The passion for winning is stronger today than it was 26 years ago. So there's been many, many times that I've gotten on a plane to come home, my heart's broken. My eyes are bloodshot from crying so much, and people don't understand why, you know, why am I crying and why am I so upset? But it's just because I want this so bad. I want to win so bad, and it doesn't go away. And that's one thing that I actually fear for the day that I do have to stop racing. If that passion doesn't subside at all, what am I going to do? And I'm going to have to figure it out. But right now, it has not dwindled in the least. I want to win probably the most out of anybody out there. And that can actually be bad sometimes when you want to win too much. So I'm trying to find that happy balance in between and enjoy the ride and make the wins come a little easier.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect place to end it. I have kept you probably far longer than you anticipated, which I appreciate very much. And it has been a pleasure. Thank you, Angel.
No problem. Thank you. I know I talk a lot. I have a lot to say. So. Yeah, somebody says, well, you sure don't have any problem talking when you do an interview. But if you talk about something you love and you're passionate about, it's easy to never shut up. And that's me. And I'm Cajun. So that's a whole another reason too. Won't find a Cajun person that's hard to talk to.
I love it. I love it. And like I said, it's perfect for a podcast, so it works for me.
Well, thanks for having me. And I hope everybody's okay with how much I talked. I hope I didn't get people to stop listening before it was over.
An absolute honor, a pleasure, let me say again, to have Angel on the podcast this week. Can't wait to see how Indianapolis wraps up as we get ready to watch the countdown for the championship in the NHRA. The Pro Stock Motorcycle Division, and really all divisions this year, have been a ton of fun to watch and is very, very competitive. And this championship fight is going to be something else. And you heard it right from Angel. She's ready to go. It's going to be a lot of fun to see how it shakes out. So thank you, Angel, for coming on the podcast, for your stories, for your insight, and sharing everything with us today about how the season's going, your career, and that fantastic story of driving a stock car back in the early 2000s. My thanks also to Allie Bland from the NHRA and pointing me in the right direction to get to Natalie Torrens, who I also want to thank for helping coordinate between Angel and I to get this interview scheduled and recorded. I hope you all enjoyed it. Please leave a rating and review wherever you're listening to this podcast today. You can also leave me feedback on social media. Go to Twitter. My handle is at Kelly Crandall. Find me on Facebook. Just make sure you're looking for the public Facebook page. That is where you will see all of my writing for racer.com, as well as links for the podcast. You can also find me if you want to interact and leave feedback through Instagram as well as LinkedIn. And Patreon, patreon.com/Kelly Crandall. I hope everyone who is subscribed over there is enjoying it. And let me know what else I could be doing to make it a better experience for you. Janet Scott deserves a shout out this week because she has increased her pledge on Patreon. And I hope she's enjoying the new level of access that you have, Janet. Again, Patreon, different tiers. Go over there, check it out. You can get my show notes, early clips before episode drops, find out who the upcoming guests are going to be, and so much more. So that is through Patreon and another way to support myself and the podcast. So thank you to everyone who is signed up. I hope others will go check it out. And once again, thank you to Janet for increasing your pledge. With that, I am going to get out of here for this week. I'm going to go back and watch the rest of the NHRA, rest of the U.S. Nationals from Indianapolis. It's so cool to have racing on a Monday on this Labor Day, so that's how I'm going to spend it. I hope that's what you'll do once you're done listening to this episode.
Next week, though, we'll be back. We're, of course, going to have another brand new episode. We're back in the NASCAR world. We're headed over to Front Row Motorsports. Sat down with Jerry Fries to get all things Front Row, as well as their three drivers over there, Zane Smith in the Truck Series, Michael McDowell and Todd Gilliland in the Cup Series. And we learn a little bit about Jerry himself. Another fantastic conversation as we dig into one of the teams that doesn't have the biggest budgets, but they've got a big fight and a big heart. And they are out there doing what they can. So really appreciate Jerry coming on the podcast and can't wait to share that with you. That'll be here next week on the Racing Writers Podcast.